Hi, it's Friday, and welcome again to another edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. You know the drill. It's me, John Zogby, and my son and partner, Jeremy Zogby. And every week, except last week, sorry, we took a pass last week, but pretty much every week, we take a look at some issues, particularly not only issues in the news, but the broader meaning and historical perspective of those issues. And then we proceed to, as pollsters would say, somewhat agree and at times somewhat or even strongly disagree with each other from two different generational points of view. And it's real and unscripted in the sense that Jeremy doesn't know what we're talking about and beforehand, and I barely know what we're talking about all during the next 25 minutes or so. Jer, how are you doing?
I'm pretty well, but I guess we didn't throw in there strongly agree, right?
No,
that rarely happens.
Rarely happens, at least not on camera, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, this week, there are two things that I'd like to talk about. The first is a tip from my good friend, now our good friend out on the West Coast, Jim Lichtman, who writes to us pretty frequently and is a faithful viewer. Jim is the author of several books, which I'm going to highly recommend because I've read all three of them. What Do You Stand For? The Case for Impeachment and Its Ethics, Stupid. And as you can tell from the titles, Jim is an author and an ethicist, and someone who has deeply influenced my thinking. And so he wrote in last week, is it possible for both sides in this country to get together and actually pass meaningful legislation? Or are those days just simply over? And I want to respond to that. I want to thank Jim for the tip because I think we have to deal with that. And I'd like to begin the process right now and ask that same question and suggest that certainly when it comes to smaller items or more reasonably sized spending items, it's possible still to get some sort of an agreement. These days, bipartisan agreement on legislation generally involves one, two, or five members of the other party jumping sides. It does not appear to involve large consensus-like numbers. But when it comes to major pieces of legislation, it seems as if the parties, which are evenly split, both in the House and the Senate, pretty much dig in. And the message that they receive and that they follow is not so much, let's get something done. Let's realize who the president is, that the president won and we lost. And therefore, because we lost, we have to give him some slack, even to the tune of what Tip O'Neill told Dick Gephardt many years ago, right after Ronald Reagan was elected and presented his first agenda in early 1981. And Democrats were debating it. And finally, Tip O'Neill, who incidentally used to have after hours glasses of scotch with Ronald Reagan, even though the two were on completely opposite sides. But he told Gephardt, you know, he won the election, Reagan. Give him the rope that he's asking for, and let's watch him hang himself. Well, the truth is that that's not really what happened. They gave Reagan some slack, and he actually did fairly well as president of the United States. But that attitude seems to be missing. We're at war. The two parties are at war. And both in the instances where Mitch McConnell was majority or minority leader under Obama and now under Biden, the operating rule is no slack whatsoever. We're going to make sure this guy doesn't get a second term. And then, quite frankly, that's what the Democrats and Harry Reid and then Chuck Schumer have pretty much done, conducted with Donald Trump. So my fear, and I know I'm going on a bit here, is that these are the pre-stages of this system coming apart at the seams. I don't think consensus will ever happen. I don't think any meaningful compromise, say on an infrastructure bill or an immigration bill or bills of that magnitude will happen. And finally, this is one of those, this is now the third similar period in American history. The first was the early 19th century and the breakup of the Federalist Party, who found themselves a distinct minority, not only in Congress, but as new states were coming in, those states were becoming Jeffersonian. And the Federalists willfully just imploded by 1814. The second period involves the Whigs and party realignment that took place before and then with the election of Abraham Lincoln. And now this is the third such period where the parties, in this case, both parties, but because they're the party of the outs in the White House, the Republicans have moved way off to the extreme, just as the Federalists and half of the Whigs did in their eras, moved way off to the extreme and are digging in. And I think that they're finding themselves against the logical demographics of this history, of our history, the growing numbers of young people who are less ideological, who just simply want to get things done, and that we're on the verge, if not of a culture war, then an all-out political war. So I'm not terribly optimistic in the short run. What do you think?
Yeah, regarding the culture war and the political war, we're there. I think we're already there. Leading up to 2016, we were kind of there. 2016, we were there. 2020, full out, I think. You know, Jim's question is a fascinating question. And immediately I made a distinction between, you know, the top of the pyramid and the bottom of the pyramid, the social pyramid. I think on the people side, if left to themselves, I have much more hope that consensus could be reached. But the real problem are the power structures that I think from the top down, all of this emanates from and looks to be like, you know, something akin to that's played throughout history in every empire, divide and conquer. And I think the real problem at play is party allegiance. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I think about the founding fathers, and not in the sense that they are saints and that they are, you know, that they should be canonized or anything like that. I mean, they were obviously human and they were, you know, very flawed people. But the amazing thing about at least many of the founding fathers was that they were products of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And as a result of being, you know, products of this intellectual movement that flowed from the European continent, they were highly steeped in the idea of natural law and observing society and trying to understand how natural law could bring about order in society. And so inherently, not to say that, because their politics was contentious and they butted heads, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, but they were inherently more substantive in what they talked about. And we have just moved from that. And you go back to Washington's farewell address, and when he warned about political factions, I just have a whole new understanding of that and what that means and interpretation. And my interpretation is, you know, on the surface, he's just, you know, basically warning about politics as usual. That's kind of how I always understood it. And that's, you know, throughout the history of civilization, different ideologies, different philosophies, you know, duking it out in the public square. But what I think he was saying that goes much deeper than that was he was warning about party allegiance. Mm-hmm. And that he saw the United States as a unique experiment and a unique nation that was really founded on freedom of agency, meaning that, you know, I think this is embodied in Jefferson's quote in his tomb in Washington, D.C. You go into Jefferson's memorial or his monument, and you look up at the dome, and the quote says, "I reject all forms of tyranny of the mind." Basically, that means freedom of agency. And I think that in the early stages of the Republic, there was, you know, that was a major backdrop, was to be free in your thought and to have no allegiance. And so party allegiance has really turned into like a religion. It's turned into a cult. And I can understand religion because, like, us, for example, we're, you know, our background is Maronite Catholic. Our Lebanese lineage has been Maronite Catholic probably since the 900s. So over 1,000 years, I can understand maintaining that tradition. But when we're talking about political parties, which the modern forms of the Democrat Party and the Republican Party are not even, are barely, you know, a little over 100 years old. What is up with this notion that my family has been Democrat or Republican for 3 generations? I have to be a Democrat. I have to vote Democrat. I have to vote Democrat, local, state, and federal. And I think that's what's killing us, is that we now equate party with religion. And there is a cultish worship of what is a duopoly, essentially a duopoly. And I think if we could break free from that, it goes back to my earlier point addressing Jim's question. I think if you just had that freedom of agency where more people thought, I can vote Republican, I can vote Democrat, and hey, I could even vote for a small third party. But a lot of this has to do with the party structure or the voting structure that won't even allow for independent and third parties. And actually, we just did a poll on that.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And what we found is, just picking up on something that you said earlier, that if left up to their own accord, the public could probably reach consensus a whole lot sooner and more efficiently than an outmoded, concretized, hierarchical party structure that operates really by its own rules and its own loyalty. I want to pick up on what you said, because I want to criticize both political parties very shortly, or very quickly. What's always troubled me about the Republican Party, the modern one, beginning with the party of Ronald Reagan and then moving on to Newt Gingrich, and as you know and everybody knows here, I've done work for both parties. I've done especially a lot of work for Republican Party. And what's always amazed me is that the premise for the party and the question that always needs to be answered is, who is the real conservative? And that is so narrowing, that is so exclusive. And basically, it is saying that we are putting an ideological need over the broader national interest. And that, picking up on what you were talking about earlier, is so contrary to the founding fathers, who were conservatives and liberals and localists and internationalists. But the one thing that they all agreed on was the need to build a national community, that there has to be fundamental principles, the Constitution, for example, that the Bill of Rights in particular, and the powers of the governments that we agree on, and then we can separate on other things. But for Republicans, the candidate has to be the true conservative, even when a good portion of those who identify themselves as Republicans out of the body populace are not really conservatives anymore. The problem on the Democratic side is something that James Carville, I think, astutely put, and that certainly backs up what I've been saying for a long time. He said, regarding the elitism of the party, he said the Democratic Party leaders and candidates speak Hebrew. The people speak Yiddish. And I thought that was very, very astute. For those who may not know what I'm getting at, is that the public is talking about putting food on the table. The public is talking about packing lunches and getting the kids to school on time. The public is talking about getting a job and keeping a job. And the party leadership is talking about progressivism versus the mainstream, who is ideologically pure and who isn't. Both parties, I think, are dinosaurs. I'm not sure that, even though personally, I will admit that I agree more with the progressive side of the Democratic Party, but if it's going to be my way or the highway, then they're going to find themselves in trouble with the American people. And they are. You notice that rarely have we had any national consensus emerging from elections in the last 20 plus years. No consensus. Look how close many of these elections have been. So we're ready to move on to, or do you want to make another point, or do I have another topic?
I would just like to jump in and say that there are two blatant contradictions, one on each side, that I always kind of chuckle at. The Republicans, they're historically, they're supposed to be the party of limited government, but they're the ones where, whether it's whether it's defense or security or the intelligence community, I mean, the budget keeps getting bigger, right? And I mean, now we're at a point where the defense budget is like $1 trillion. And so the blatant contradiction is, how can you be both a limited government and an empire, a global empire? Like, that's just not possible. That's a complete contradiction. And the one that always kills me about the Democrats is, there was, and this was especially true when I was in college, there was such this strain on the left, not necessarily encompassing all of the left, but with Democrats, that there was distrust towards multinational corporations. But what I see in the last 4 or 5 years is anything but distrust in the multinational corporations, especially when it comes to the field of medicine, when it comes to the media they consume. They keep flocking back to, the big news networks. And so that just always seemed to me as a major contradiction. But then this is where they come together, and this is where they're shooting themselves in their feet, is they're both engaging in identity politics. So on the left, the identity politics has become the LGBTQ movement, which, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that it's interesting that such a small, percentage of the population has become like front and center, the main issue. And then on the right, they were doing this with gay marriage and with abortions. And I mean, so they've really taken these issues and they've put them at the forefront, and these have become the most heated issues that people are at each other's throats over. And I just find that fascinating. And I think that I think they're kind of hurting themselves by doing that. But you wanted to move on.
Yeah, I we will have more of these conversations. And so I will have more commentary later about that. I've been getting calls from reporters, mainly foreign reporters, about Biden's trip overseas, and in particular, obviously, the meeting coming up early next week with Vladimir Putin. And what do I expect to come from that? And what could go right or what could go wrong? And so, I mean, here's what I've been telling the reporters is, number one, it is with our allies, particularly in Western Europe. On the surface, there, as you saw with the meeting with Boris Johnson just yesterday, that there the effort is to assure that America is with NATO, is with Western allies, to shore up that trust that was lost under Donald Trump. But the pitfall there is that I think one of the things that Donald Trump at least did right was to, without saying it this way, was to recognize the United States can't foot the bill for allies, and that neither, no candidate or no president could ever say this. The United States just isn't what it used to be. It cannot be the dominant superpower and fund everybody's military and lead every charge. And it's certainly, we've seen the inability of the American military, A, to improve things, B, to win over hearts and minds, and C, to actually be the strongest military power in the world. Secondly, when it comes to Putin, other presidents have made mistakes. You know, notably, you had George W. Bush, who met with Putin and famously said, I looked into his eyes and I saw his heart, and we bonded with each other. Well, I don't think anyone has ever said that about Vladimir Putin before, and no one has ever said that afterward. And there was certain naivety there. And the second issue was that as Secretary of State under Obama, Hillary Clinton came to Russia with the great reset button. And there was a complete misunderstanding of Russian history and Russian culture. Neither of us understand each other. We both have a history that draws us to empire. The United States as the most virtuous, rights-oriented country in the world feels that God is on our side and we need to spread that throughout the world. Putin and Russia, and in between the Soviet Union, have felt that they were exposed to the West, victims of too many invasions and slaughters. And it's meant not only an emphasis on defense, but also an emphasis on building a wide perimeter that allows it to prevent against other invasions, but also to be economically independent. Hence, in both instances, empires. I don't think the two of us will ever understand that. And it's not in Vladimir Putin's interests to have any understanding of the United States. And it's probably not politically in the interests yet of any American president to say, we're going to lighten up and understand and appreciate the Russians. In between, there was Donald Trump. And we never knew where with Donald Trump the meetings began or ended with new high-rise hotels or with a dossier responding to blackmail or just a foreign policy that was based on personal needs. In any event, what can happen with this trip? I don't think very much, except at least an appreciation by Biden that Putin is here to stay. And if Putin is going to topple, it's going to be of his own accord. Putin is in some deep trouble domestically, more than he's ever seen before. And on Putin's end, a recognition that, hey, I'm dealing with a pro. This guy's got over five decades experience dealing in foreign policy. He's no pushover, and he's probably got the best foreign policy resume of any president, perhaps since Nixon. So those are just some comments about this trip. What do you think? What do you think anybody can get out of this trip?
I think you're right. Nothing. Because unfortunately, it looks to be more about optics. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's good that that the tradition of diplomacy, right, and meeting is still taking place. But I mean, when you're talking about the grand game of the global chessboard, there's always more than what meets the eye. And, you know, there's no secret that the United States wants to be the power, right? They want a unipolar world. The American empire in DC, led by, you know, the defense and the security complex, want a world that is dominated by the United States, kind of like what has been since 1945. Of course, there was the Cold War and Russia was the other power, but the United States has the world reserve currency. The system is on a system of the dollar. Most trade takes place through the dollar. Nations, when they buy oil, probably over 90% conduct the trade in dollars. And that's actually at threat, because China and Russia want a more unipolar world. And this, you know, they called it in history dollar diplomacy, but mm-hmm. today we call it the weaponization of the dollar, where if you are a threat to that desire of the American empire to operate outside of this system, there are sanctions. You are sanctioned. Iran, Russia. Of course, it's hard to do that with China, because there's so much trade between the two nations, although, you know, there was some hostility under the Trump presidency. But I mean, really what's going on here is China and Russia want to abandon that system of global trade being dominated by the US dollar. It is just not in their interest to bow down to the United States when they have this grand vision called the Belt Road Initiative, otherwise known as the Silk Road 2.0, where they have the prospect. Imagine what the Erie Canal did in the 19th mm-hmm. century, where you could go from London across Atlantic to New York, up the Hudson River, hang around at the bend in Albany and Schenectady, then go all the way through and then reach the Great Lakes, and then make your way to the Mississippi River down through New Orleans and back. And that was unbelievable. The world had never seen anything. But now with this Belt Road Initiative, you have a Eurasian Silk Road 2.0 that involves airports, high-speed rails, sea route trades, and the most sophisticated technology that will make what the Erie Canal did look like ancient, basically. And that's really what's at play here, is mm-hmm. that new system threatening American dominance and the American financial dominance through the U.S. dollar. And we just saw about a week ago, one of Russia's, if not the largest sovereign wealth fund, dumped its dollar assets in the hundreds of billions. So that's really what's at the root of it here.
Well, thank you for that history lesson. I'm thanking you on behalf of everybody who's listening and watching. We did a lot today. We could go on, but let me just say to the viewers, follow our buddy Jim Lipman's lead. He got us started on this topic. Please avoid conspiracies, who was behind 9/11, QAnon. Please write to us some topics that you'd like us to address, and we'll gladly do it. Please share the audio and the video with others. Please send us your comments about what we're doing right. And we'll see you next week.